one of the masters of psychological warfare during which I was put in charge of this diversionary tactic in the late 1940s. General Walter Biddell Smith helped coordinate the psychological warfare components of this ET problem and launched the big lie, UFOs, even though thousands of people had reported seeing them, did not exist. For every sighting which made its way into the public eye, there would be an official denial and worse, ridicule of the observers themselves. Harvard astronomer Donald Menzel was trotted out to tell the world that it was all hysteria, that UFOs were not real, that it was all embarrassing nonsense. While all this denial was going on, an interstellar species was being interrogated in a top-secret underground bunker. The surviving extraterrestrial from the first Roswell crash was referred to as an EBEN, which is short for extraterrestrial biological entity. It had a chlorophyll-based internal anatomy and it processed food into energy and waste material in the same manner as plants. We learned a lot from EBEN, all of which was compiled into what became known as the Yellow Book. Unfortunately, the EBEN became ill in late 1951. Several medical specialists were brought in to treat it, the team headed by a botanist. Realizing the ET was dying, the United States began broadcasting radio signals into deep space in an attempt to demonstrate peaceful intentions to a superior entity. The group tasked with overseeing this project, codenamed Sigma, was the National Security Agency, created by secret executive order on November 4, 1952. The NSA was assigned to monitor all communications, both human and extraterrestrial, while maintaining secrecy regarding the UFO's presence. Both the CIA and NSA were given authority through a series of National Security Council memos and executive orders. On June 2, 1952, EBEN died. Steven Spielberg's movie, E.T. was loosely based on these events. Truman contacted our allies to warn them about what happened. He also reached out to the Soviet Union. It turns out their top-secret weapons bases were also being buzzed by extraterrestrial vehicles, ETVs. President Truman and the other leaders he alerted decided that maintaining secrecy was more important than sharing the information with their respective governing bodies and risking a leak. A new world order was necessary, one that operated without oversight. Testimonial. Philip Corso Jr. is the son of Colonel Philip S. Corso, Sr., U.S. Army intelligence who served on President Eisenhower's National Security Council. His father personally saw deceased extraterrestrials from the Roswell crash in 1947 and a UFO craft at an air base. While working in R&D, Corso Sr. was given fragments of extraterrestrial technologies from various crashes to seed industry with these technologies. My father knew from the reports that the Roswell ET had passed away. It simply turned from blue to brown and died like a fish out of water. Now I'll tell you something about the ET. My father often spoke of a room in the Pentagon, like a jail door, and you slid it back and you went in there and you were not able to take any pencil, paper, recording device. You simply viewed documents and you came out with whatever you could store in your head. Once or twice he led me to believe that there was something else that was kept in those rooms that would give information. He had a thread also that was from the clothing. He says that the ship's skin and the alien's silver suit were similar materials. And yes, absolutely, Dad was aware of other crashes. He says that the Germans told him they had a crash and that most of their technology and their advanced materials and research came from that. This was part of a team that he worked with every day. And he said that there was another crash in Corona, New Mexico of a very similar type ship. Testimonial. Lieutenant Colonel Charles Brown, U.S. Air Force. After returning from World War II an Air Force hero, Colonel Brown worked in the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. He was assigned to work on Project Grudge where he was responsible for investigating UFOs. I'm retired Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Air Force. I spent approximately 23 years in military service, and the latter 7 years as a senior Foreign Service officer. I started training as a pilot in July of 1942 and was commissioned as a second lieutenant pilot in April of 1943, then trained as a B-17 pilot aircraft commander. I went to Europe and arrived there in early November of 1943 and commenced combat as a B-17 pilot on the 13th of December 1943. I flew my 29th and last complete mission on the 11th of April 1944. Combat during this period was fairly severe. I just completed a survey of my missions, and every time we went into the air, we had casualties. And I was very fortunate to complete all of them. Because of my counterintelligence training and police work in an outfit called Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and because I was one of the few pilot-trained investigators, I ended up doing a lot of investigations of aircraft, unusual aircraft accidents, in which sabotage was suspected. As a result, I became acquainted with some outstanding scientists and worked with the Air Technical Intelligence Center on a project called Grudge. We were given the responsibility of investigating what became known as unidentified flying objects. My job was in District DO5 of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where we received these worldwide reports. My job was to hand carry these reports over to the technical center and coordinate them with the project officer and answer any questions from an investigative viewpoint that I could assist on. I did that for approximately 2 years until the fall of 1951. Normally in the investigative field, you have an allegation of something, or in the case of a UFO, a sighting. You carry it through to its conclusion and result. When an object is moving a few thousand miles an hour, 12 to 14 minutes is a tremendous amount of time. I do remember speeds in excess of 4,000 to 5,000 miles an hour, which were far in excess of any known aircraft that we had or any of the enemies had. Being an intelligence officer, one of my responsibilities was to have at least a rough idea of enemy capabilities and of their equipment. Once, we flew into Nellis Air Force Base and another pilot and I were flying a Goonie Bird, C-47A Skytrain. The sky was totally clear. And an object went across southwest to northeast and it transited the entire heaven, looking at it from my right, and it went out of sight on the left in less than 15 seconds. It was moving at a speed that I couldn't even begin to calculate. It was certainly no satellite. It was a controlled object in flight. Some of the objects reported were tracked on radar. We had objects with four-way confirmation, ground visual, ground radar, airborne visual, airborne radar. And so far as I'm concerned, it doesn't get any better than that. You are not talking about someone's imagination. And in this same time frame, I heard so-called experts that the Air Force brought in concoct stories, from swamp gas to things like that. If it's an aircraft with wings, then the laws of aerodynamics apply, and you don't stop that thing and reverse it in a blink of an eye. And things like that did occur. Later when I was in Britain, they were having a NATO exercise out in the North Sea area. And a couple of these little friendly balls of light got in the traffic pattern. Well, you can imagine what happened when they flew over the deck without landing, needless to say. And it threw the Navy into absolute consternation. Well, the newspapers picked it up, and in those days, they were able to talk to the sailors and the airmen involved. And everyone is screaming for an investigation. President Truman knew about these objects. I've seen radar photographs of organized lights of unidentified objects, balls of light, if you will, over the White House. Now the airborne visual, strangely enough, by the time you get a couple of fighters down there, those things apparently disappeared whenever they wanted to. Truman saw all of the newspaper headlines and said, "I want the man who is responsible for investigating these things." Someone said, "General Sanford is the chief of Air Force Intelligence." The president replied, "Is he the guy that's handling the investigation?" They said, "No, sir. That would be a man out at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base." So they flew me to Washington. It is sort of strange, but we send people to prison, we send people to their death because of eyewitness accounts of crimes. Our legal system is based on that to a large degree. Yet in my following of unusual aerial phenomena for the past 50 years, there seems to be some reason to discredit very viable and very reputable witnesses when they say something is unidentified. Well, you show me the individual who can identify everything in the heavens, and I will show you the second coming. Because I don't care how technically qualified you are. For someone who is not there to voice an opinion and say they saw such and such is nonsense. And my question is, what qualified them to be experts? And I have a real problem with that. I truly believe that these phenomena have been visiting this planet long before Project Grudge. I think there is adequate evidence of it. And the more we learn about the universe, the more we realize how little we truly know. And so the advance of science is something that has to keep evolving and we have to keep learning. Testimonial. Sergeant Clifford Stone, U.S. Army, has seen living and dead extraterrestrials himself in his official duties on an Army team that retrieved crashed ET crafts. He has been given access to black ops bases and secret access projects. In the 1950s, the United States Air Force had an elite unit to investigate UFOs outside of Blue Book. Even though Blue Book felt that this unit was working with them, they were not. This unit was initially organized as the 4602nd Air Intelligence Service Squadron. Among its peacetime missions was Operation Blue Fly. The objective of Operation Blue Fly was to recover objects of unknown origin that fell to Earth. It is very important that you remember these were specifically objects that fell to Earth, because we didn't have any spacecraft up there at this time. As a result of this, they had monitors right there at Wright-Patterson that when UFO reports came in, they were looked at very closely to see if there was any possible necessity of sending out teams to recover any of this fallen debris. The Air Force states they never used them. I'm telling you, I know they did. But the intent of the Operation Blue Fly peacetime project was to go out and recover objects of unknown origin that impacted with the Earth. Later it would be expanded in 1957 to cover all objects of unknown origin, meaning spacecraft too. And it would become part of what they would call in the October of 1957 time frame, Project Moondust. Project Moondust was established to recover only two items. First, objects of non-US origin that survived re-entry into the atmosphere and their impact with the Earth. The other area of interest was objects of unknown origin. Naturally, we would be interested in those items from a technical, scientific intelligence basis to ascertain the technical capabilities of any potential enemy, since our known enemy of the US, the USSR at that time, was launching vehicles into space. Now we find that there were quite a few objects of unknown origin that did not correlate with any known space launches, impact times, or any known space debris falling back to Earth. In short, under Project Moondust and under Blue Fly, we have recovered alien debris not of this Earth. The degree of classification that we have now has changed over the years. Back during the time of the Second World War all the way up to, say, 1969, you may have had as many as 11 classifications. Now there are 3, confidential, secret and top secret. However, if you have information that is highly sensitive that requires protection above and beyond the norm of what is provided for those classifications, that's when you have the special access programs. You do not get that type of information out into public domain unless it is officially sanctioned. During the discussion of UFOs, the question ultimately is going to come up, can any government keep secrets, let alone the US government? And the answer to that is unequivocally yes. But one of the greatest weapons the intelligence community has at their disposal is a predisposition by the American people, the American politicians, and the debunkers. People who wish to try to debunk UFO information. They immediately come out and say, oh, we can't keep secrets. Well, the truth is, yes, we can. The National Reconnaissance Office remained secret for many, many years. The mere existence of the NSA remained secret. The development of the atomic weapon remained secret until once you exploded, one you eventually had to tell some people what was going on. And we are conditioned by our own paradigms not to accept the possibility or probability of a highly advanced intelligent civilization coming here to visit us. You have evidence in the form of highly credible reports of objects being seen, of the entities inside these objects being seen. Yet, we look for a prosaic explanation and we throw out the bits and pieces of the evidence that do not meet our paradigm. So it is a self-keeping secret. You can conceal it in plain sight. It is political suicide to go and start hitting up intelligence agencies to get this information released. So most of your members of Congress, and I know I've worked with a lot of them along that line, will balk and try not to do it. I can name you three members of Congress that were point blank asked to have a congressional inquiry on what happened here at Roswell. One of the most ridiculous statements that I got was that a person would have to be a chairperson to do that. So I asked a senator from Mississippi if he'd do it, and without any hesitation, he said no. I said, "Would you give me that in writing?" "I got that in writing, but I'm hesitant to release it." "I will show it to you, but I'm hesitant to release it simply because I made a promise not to. We have got to get the documentation as it exists in the government files. We have got to get it released before it is ultimately destroyed." A good example are the Blue Flyer and Moon Dust files. I had classified documents the Air Force acknowledged. When I got members of Congress to help me open up more files, they were immediately destroyed, and I can prove this. Somewhere along the line they may see that material and realize there is some very highly sensitive information that would have a damning effect upon the national security of United States should it become compromised. It needs to be further protected to ensure that there is only a limited access to that information to a small number of people. So small you can put them on a single piece of paper and list them by name. Thus, you have the special access programs. The controls that were supposed to be put on the special access programs are not there. When Congress did their review of the way we protect documents and the way we go ahead and implement our secrecy programs, they found you had special access programs within special access programs. It was essentially impossible to keep control of them all by Congress. And I'm telling you right now, it is essentially impossible to keep control of them all. When it comes to UFOs, the same criteria applies. Therefore, only a small nucleus within the intelligence community numbering less than 100. No, I'd suggest less than 50. Control all that information. It is not subject to congressional review or oversight at all. So Congress needs to go ahead and ask the hard questions and convene a hearing. There would be quite a few missions to describe, but simply put, yes, I was involved in those types of operations to retrieve crashed ET objects. A lot of people think that you are just in your unit waiting in the rafters, just waiting for the next UFO crash, a landing where there is going to be debris. It doesn't work that way. You have a real life. You have a real job in the military. However, if you are in an area where an event takes place and you are one of these people that they can go ahead and call upon in your field of expertise, then you are called in. Testimonial. Dan Morris is a retired Air Force career master sergeant who was involved in the extraterrestrial projects for many years. After leaving the Air Force, he was recruited into the Super Secret National Reconnaissance Organization, or NRO, during which time he worked specifically on extraterrestrial connected operations. He had a cosmic top secret clearance, 38 levels above top secret, which, he states, no US president, to his knowledge, has ever held. When I was stationed at Air Proving Ground Command in Florida, they were going to send me to Warner Robins Air Force Base with a team, and with the two most powerful radars we had at the time. And Strategic Air Command. That's when SAC was on alert all the time. Was going to run penetration missions against us. It was all secret who was there. The commander of the base didn't know this unit was there. All they were thinking was that we were marked as a weather squadron, and we had nothing to do with the weather. Anyway, we got our equipment set up at Warner Robins, and we were operating. We'd been there for about a month. We were working on the big tower one day, it was down for maintenance, and there were five of us on the tower and two guys down in the control room. Somebody said, "Look, UFOs." "Yeah, yeah?" I don't think that anybody turned round and looked. That was the days of the Blue Book, and if you said you saw a UFO, they'd send you to the hospital and you'd be examined by a psychiatrist to see why you wanted out of the Air Force. Or they'd ship you out to somewhere else to shut you up. Then, J. Allen Hynek, who was a technical advisor to Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He was hired officially by the Blue Book Project to shut everybody up. Come up with something. Either autosuggestion, mass hypnosis, or swamp gas. Those were his three statements that he would usually come up with. Somebody said, "Just turn around and look." So, we all turned around and there, sitting about, I'd say, a half a mile from the tower, at about 3,000 feet altitude, were three silver UFOs. So we all walked over to the rope and said, "Yeah, those are real UFOs." And I said, "Okay, if Hynek comes up here, or if they send a team up here, what are we going to say?" Somebody said, "There's about 20,000 civilians and about 10,000 military on this base. Somebody else is bound to have seen these, so when they say it's mass hypnosis, or autosuggestion, or swamp gas, let's go down and turn the radar on, because none of that paints on the radar." So, we all went down. Now, the two guys who were down the dot, I asked them, "You got your cameras, official Air Force cameras? Go outside and take pictures, go out and tell me what you see." They came back and said, "There are UFOs sitting out there in formation." I said, "Well, take pictures. Get the cameras and take pictures." And, I told the other two, "Turn the radar cameras on," because we had radar cameras that took pictures, too. So that was all there, and this building we were in had one whole side that was glass French doors. So if you set the radar scope, you'd look outside and see there were UFOs. And so I called headquarters. I said, "Okay, we have a contact." He says, "You mean SAC is running a mission against you?" I said, "Not SAC, not SAC." He says, "What, then?" I said, "Cosmos." He said, "Wait a minute. Describe them on the phone." There was a switch you could throw that scrambles everything. So I said, "Okay, my phone's scrambled. Is yours scrambled?" "Mine's scrambled," he says. "What do you mean you've got a cosmic contact?" I said, "I mean there are three UFOs sitting out there. You taking pictures?" "We're taking pictures." "You taking radar pictures?" "We're taking radar pictures." "Taking real pictures?" He says, "Okay, don't say another word, I will send a courier up there. He'll get there in about 6 hours. You turn everything over to him." And I said, "Okay." About 6 hours later, he's there, we've got everything sealed up for him, we give it to him, he heads back to Air Proving Ground Command. And we were never officially notified that they ever received those pictures. It went secret, it went black. Like it never happened. But, we had copies of the pictures. So I told the guys. The five. I said, "Okay, guys, here's a copy for all of you. Keep them for your grandkids." Now, as far as I know, that mission was closed. But that got us all interested, because we had seen some facts, you know. Not radar scopes, not things in crypto. But we were there, and we had pictures of them. When they started moving and the radar antennae went around. The trace on your scope went around 4 sweeps per minute. By the time we had painted them, they were out of sight. Once they started moving, they went straight up, and then they went, zap. And they were off our scope. Our scope would go out to 260 miles, so you calculate that, and that's pretty fast. We never had anything back then that could go that fast in the inventory. This was in the 1940s. Do you know why we stopped exploding nuclear weapons? We were ordered to do it by those ETs from Orion. Orion. They came down and they told us, "Look, you can destroy yourselves, So we won't put up with that. If you do that dot, if you explode that planet dot and you've got the capability now, that's when we really got their attention, and they came down and they said, look, we won't let you destroy your planet, so we want you to stop all nuclear testing. They had already stopped us from using weapons, and then they told us, no more nuclear testing. Now Russia and the United States. We were firm believers, by then, that those beings could do what they said. And you saw the time they all showed up over Washington, D.C., and we sent our jets up after them, and every time the jets would go up, the UFOs would zap out, or they'd go to another dimension. The jets would come back to base and the UFOs would be back over Washington. Scared the hell out of everybody in Washington. What are they going to do? Testimonial. Don Phillips, U.S. Air Force and contractor at Lockheed Skunk Works and the CIA, worked with Kelly Johnson at the Lockheed Skunk Works on design and construction of the U-2 and the SR-71 Blackbird. He was in the Air Force at Las Vegas Air Force Base during a major UFO event. We know that there were some captured craft from 1947 in Roswell, New Mexico. And, yeah, they were real. And, yes, we really did get some technology from them. And, yes, we really did put it to work. I entered college after high school, but I also went to work for Lockheed Aircraft Corporation. My studies had to do with design, engineering, mechanical, electrical and aeronautics. I was a private pilot at that time, and still am. In 1961, I started my new job in what is called the Lockheed Skunk Works. When I left to join the military, I felt that this was something I wanted to come back to after serving my country. In 1965 I went into the military and discovered that some of my assignments placed me near Las Vegas, Nevada, in close proximity to areas where we tested our aircraft, an area commonly known as Area 51. We call it Dreamland, the hog farm, the lake. People always want to know what is happening out there. We are testing airplanes, special aircraft, such as the Blackbird, which I am very proud of because that's my baby. And it still holds some of the world's records to this day. Now, the thing about being in the military in that area is that we had radar sites attached to Nellis Air Force Base. Nellis is a flight test and pilot training base for the US military. North of Las Vegas, way up past the northeast end of the gunnery range, is what we know as Area 51. Across the highway that goes north from Las Vegas is a site called Angel's Peak. Angel's Peak covers Area 51, but it also covered a lot of other areas, like the Atomic Energy Commission test grounds to the west and to the north. So Angel's Peak was a classified radar installation. We would monitor the aircraft coming from Las Vegas into Area 51 or whatever passed by. And, it was whatever passed by that became most interesting one night in 1966. That night, I heard a lot of commotion about 1 o'clock in the morning. We were at 8,000 feet, the radar domes were at approximately 10,500 feet. I decided to get up and walked to the main road near my office. I got to the area where a group of about 5 people were standing and they were looking up in the air. As I looked up, I saw these lighted objects moving at tremendous speeds. It was in the area slightly to the north-northwest of Mount Charleston. Right at that instant I saw these things traveling, I would estimate at 3,000 to 4,000 miles per hour. And then immediately make acute turns. I had a special background with the Skunk Works, Lockheed Aircraft Advanced Development and Engineering, and knew these were not ours. And, having been a pilot, I'm thinking, if there are people in these craft, what kind of forces are their bodies taking? It went on for about another 90 seconds. And then all of a sudden, they seemed to group hundreds of miles in the sky to the west. They came into a circle, rotated, and then disappeared. And I thought, wow, what a show. The security sergeant happens to be on duty. We all looked at each other and said, gee, this is really something. He said, we shouldn't really say anything about this. I had a buddy that was a chief radar operator named Anthony Kazar. Anthony was the first one to get off of the bus after the door opened. I looked at him and he was as serious as anybody could possibly be and as white as a sheet. He took one step down and looked at me and said, "Did you see those?" I said, "Yeah, we've been watching them, some of the fellows for the last 4 to 5 minutes, and I've seen them for a little more than 90 seconds.